The fact that he was being so nice about it meant that, of course, I was going to continue to do the show. There was no way I couldn't after that. I was distraught. I didn't think there was a chance we can get the filming done. And I felt like a fucking asshole for waiting so long to get the answer. I called the producers thinking it was the last time I'd ever talk to them. "Listen, guys," I said, "I hate to have to make this call, but there's no way I can get 3 weeks off on the show. I just can't do it. I can't quit the show to do the movie, and all that time off is out of the question. So I guess we can't do it." They were quiet. I figured they were getting ready to fire me, but they weren't. They didn't want me to leave the show. The show was what they had banked on to promote the film and make it profitable. "Well, here's what we're going to do," they said. "It's going to be a lot of hard work, but you're going to do it. You'll do the show in the morning, and in the afternoon, you'll be shooting." They rearranged a 5-week shoot, with the first 2 weeks falling during my vacation from the Stern Show in July. I'd have to work 2 6-day weeks, and then spend the last 3 weeks shooting every day after the show. They redid the budget and the schedule, did everything to accommodate me, and had me home most nights to get enough sleep to be functional on air at 6 a.m. 3 weeks of 18-hour days was going to be tough, but as long as I was healthy, I knew I could do it. At first, I was angry with Howard for not saying, "Just go do it," but I realized I had to suck it up. That was the only time I've ever had negative feelings toward him in the 7 years I've been at the show. What I wasn't seeing was that he was also being supportive. After that conversation, it was kind of chilly between us, and I know I walked around with a bit of an attitude. "Look, Artie," he said to me one day, "I need you here at the show. I want you here. We need you here every day." "I know, Howard, but you know I want to do this. This movie means a lot to me. And now it's going to be really hard. I can't give him my all if I'm burning the candle at both ends like this." "Listen, ultimately, if you do it that way, it'll be the best thing for the movie, because you'll be talking about it every single day while you shoot it. That's more airtime than you get if you just went off and shot it and weren't on the show for 3 weeks. He was right in every way. So we were all set to shoot in July. I looked at the calendar and circled June 4th. It was the last day of my DVD tour and the last day I'd let myself take pills. I planned to start kicking 1 month before, taking less and less, so that by June 4th, I'd be able to stop altogether and be clean. I'd have a full month of regular, sober living, then I'd show up and make a movie. That never happened, so I had to go my backup plan, quitting cold turkey. Of course, that didn't work out so well either, because I had no idea how terrible painkiller withdrawal could be. Every time I tried to cut back, I felt horrible physically and so anxious that I never really put a dent in how many I was taking. Pretty soon, June 4th was a mountain looming up ahead, and I was definitely going to crash into it. It was terrible. The only good thing that came from the stress, worry, and pills was that I lost a lot of weight. I remember being on tour and running out of pills at a club on a Friday and having to do a signing the next day and thinking there was no way I'd be able to get up in the morning and sit there for 3 hours meeting fans. I asked a guy in the club if he knew where I can get some pills, and he hooked me up with a dealer who could get just about anything. I told this kid I needed 100 Vicodin if he can get them. The kid looked at me like my head just turned around. "You want how much?" 100, I said. 100 Vicodin. "You selling them or something?" "No, they're for me." He looked confused. "Listen, man, that's a lot of Vicodin for one guy. How many are you taking?" "You know, like 10, maybe more a day." "What? Holy shit, man, that's a lot. All that Vicodin is bad for your liver. Do you know what that shit does to your liver?" "Yeah, I know, but what am I going to do?" "What are you going to do? There's a lot of things you could take that are better than that. You could use some heroin, man. Let me get you a couple dime bags. You just snort it and you'll get the same effect. Forget about taking all those pills. Take heroin, man. I'm telling you, it's better for your liver." That seemed perfectly logical to me. "Right," I said. Okay, I'll just snort some heroin instead." The guy brought me 2 dime bags after my set that night, and I went back to my hotel room wondering what was going to happen. In my life, I'd done tons of coke. But even in my biggest coke phase, I stayed away from heroin. Back in my room, I had about 1 million things to think over and discuss with the Beer League crew. We wanted to get Ralph Macchio involved. We had to cast the actress who was going to play my girlfriend, and we had to talk about a bunch of other auditions. I wanted nothing to do with any of it. Not that night. I laid down a couple lines, snorted them up, and a great euphoria washed over me. I remember hitting the couch and nothing more. All was quiet. But just before I passed out, I heard my own voice, as if from across the room, saying, "I am in trouble." Overnight, scoring pills became a thing of the past. Scoring heroin became my new hobby. In typical paranoid druggy logic, I decided that I'd be able to keep things together, or at least undercover, if I didn't score too close to home. I found a dealer who put me in touch with another dealer in Wilmington, Delaware, and that guy became my supplier. And so my life very quickly became ruled by chaos. From March to June, a regular week for me went like this. I'd be on the road all weekend doing the heroin I brought along. I'd do the gig. I'd do the signing. I'd get myself through Sunday night and do the show Monday morning. The withdrawals would start to kick in for me around 11 a.m., just as we wrapped it up. I'd make a quick exit, get in my car, and drive 3 hours to Wilmington, sweating and feeling sicker with each passing minute. I'd try to buy as little as possible, hoping to cut down how much I was doing. That didn't happen, so I'd end up driving down there 3 days a week. I hate to be judgmental, but heroin deals aren't the most reliable guys. Sometimes I'd drive all the way to Wilmington, and the kid would never show up. I'd sit in my car in a deserted alley behind a factory, desperately calling his cell phone. The withdrawal symptoms coming on strong. More than once, I waited all night for him, too desperate to risk missing him. I'd have to bail before I got too sick to make the drive back and miss work the next day. On those nights, I'd call a different guy on the way home who could always get me pills. I'd take enough to stop the shake so I can make it through the show. Then I'd drive back down to Wilmington to score again. Usually the kid never had what he said he would. Sometimes it would be a big score, and sometimes it was barely enough to scrape by, and not nearly enough to justify my trip. But the worst thing was his voicemails. "Hey man, where were you yesterday?" he'd say. "I waited for you, man. You weren't here. I got your stuff, so you better get here today." He didn't have to tell me twice. I knew I had a matter of hours and a handful of pills before I'd be in bad shape. While this commute was going on, the Beer League crew expected me to be part of all aspects of pre-production. I blew it all off. Script reads, auditions, wardrobe meetings. I always had something to do, which was true, just nothing constructive and nothing I was going to tell them about. At the time, I was getting $20,000 or so for stand-up gigs, so I had the cash to support my habit. I'd ask for half of it in cash from the promoter, so the people who kept track of my finances wouldn't see that there was all this money being spent. It was such a crazy time in my life. I'm amazed that so many things that could have happened didn't. I could have been pulled over at any time driving back and forth to Wilmington High. When I was either high or coming down, I speeded. I drove like a reckless, desperate drug addict trying to fend off paralyzing withdrawals. I could have gotten in a car accident. I could have killed somebody. I could have gotten arrested. I didn't exactly meet my dealer in the most scenic section of Wilmington. I could have gotten shot or killed, sitting there in my car for hours in the middle of the night. And even when I did score, I could have died from getting shit drugs, or I could have thrown up and passed out on the air. The possibilities were endless. None of it happened, so I kept at it, thinking I was on top of things. I had a girlfriend at the time, Dana, and I was keeping all this stuff from her, too. In the same way that I blew off the movie stuff, which had been so important to me, I blew off Dana. We'd have Saturday night plans to go to dinner, and I'd be unable to leave the house. I'd come up with some excuse why I couldn't make it. It drove a spike into our relationship, and slowly we grew apart. And I was getting into heroin deeper and deeper. I was in Dallas with Dana when I contemplated shooting it for the first time, and thank God I didn't. I also never smoked coke or crack, even though both were within reach many times. There's no doubt in my mind that if I'd started shooting or smoking the drugs, I'd be dead by now. I just kept snorting more and more, as everything I had to accomplish in just a few short months seemed increasingly impossible. The movie was being set up and my schedule had to be decided. I walked around resenting Howard for not giving me time off. It wasn't that it was such a tough schedule. It was that it was a schedule I couldn't manage on drugs. That's what I wish I could have told Howard. With just a month to go before shooting was to begin, my goal was to do whatever I needed to do to get through the movie. I had no idea how I'd do this on drugs, since I was in every scene. I had to carry the picture, and my fear and paranoia didn't help me shoulder that responsibility. I started to feel trapped. I couldn't back out of it, but I didn't think I could do it either. Our money came from guys from New Jersey, and that was enough to start my wheels spinning. I had fantasies of pulling out a movie and finding out that the mafia had put the money up, which, God knows, might still be the case. You don't want to go back on your word with guys like that when they hold up their end of the bargain. In my head, I was convinced that this would end one of two ways. I'd either get fired from Howard or be killed by Jersey Goodfellas. If I didn't die, I'd lose my career and be broke in 2 years. So a grave at the bottom of the Hudson River didn't sound so bad. By June 4th, I wasn't off drugs, but everything was moving along. Frank had gotten the script in shape all by himself, and he did a great job. The producer, my friend Anthony Mastromoro, kept it all together. He'd gotten a lot of decent names to be in it, like Ralph Macchio. My friend Laurie Metcalf from The Norm Show agreed to play my mom, and she was great. Exciting stuff was happening. And then, in the biggest coup ever, we got Seymour Cassell, and that brought the whole thing up to another level. It didn't matter to me. I was depressed. I knew that it was the end of the party. I barely got through my signing at the Virgin Megastore in downtown Chicago. Not many people showed up, which is good, because I was rude and belligerent and the signing was awful. The gig that followed was a bad one, too. It was at the Airy Crown Theater in Chicago, and it was the single worst stand-up performance I've ever done aside from my first open mic attempt. I drank, and I did more drugs than usual that night, and it was weird to be on stage. I was so out of my mind that I started to hallucinate. I didn't know if it was depression, booze, heroin, or all of the above. But standing there, all of a sudden, I realized that people were yelling at me. Not in the usual way the audience yells during stand-up shows. They were yelling at me because I was repeating jokes. It took me a while to make out what they were saying because everything was blurry and moving very slowly for me. "You just told that one, you fucking drunk prick." They called me a drug addict, a drunk. They told me they wanted their money back. They were right. They deserved it. I was in another dimension of high. At one point, I stood there waving my hand back and forth in front of my face, seeing two of them and enjoying that immensely. It was the most surreal moment I've ever had on stage. I was contracted to do 45 minutes on stage, and I did them, so they had to pay me. I had arranged to get 15 grand by check and 5 in cash. And as I sat in the promoter's office while he got it together, I could hear the crowd in the alley behind the stage door going crazy. The guys out there were pissed, banging the door yelling, "Fuck that guy. He ripped us off. That show sucked." I was still high and really paranoid. I was convinced that I was about to get the shit kicked out of me. "Hey man," I said to the promoter, "can you get me a ride back to the hotel?" I got back to my room where I had one bag of heroin left in my suitcase. I planned to do it Sunday when I got off the plane, which would last me through that night and the Stern show the next morning. I didn't know what made me think I could just kick heroin like it was Twinkies, but it was the same type of logic that convinced me it was okay to cut a few lines up from that bag. Fuck it. I gotta get through this tour, and the movie guys are happy. Howard hasn't fired me. We're making a movie. Fuck it. I'm going to sleep. When my alarm went off on Monday morning, June 6, 2005, at 4:45 a.m., the contents of that bag had passed entirely through my system and were long gone. I was at DEFCON 5. I was sweating, panicked, paranoid, and controlled by a deep chemical need. I made it to the show, but I was like a corpse. I barely said anything. I tried to eat. I tried to drink, but nothing went down. I was thin and sweaty. I thought about driving to get more heroin once we were done, but as every minute ticked by, I realized that I couldn't go anywhere. I finished the show, slipped away before anyone could talk to me, went home, and curled up in a ball. After an hour or two, I called the Beer League production office, which was just 3 blocks from my apartment, and told them I couldn't make it today. I said I was sick, but I'd be there tomorrow. They were pissed. They'd set all this up with no help from me, and I couldn't make a meeting 3 blocks away. They had no idea how much more pissed they were going to get. I spent the rest of that day going through utter drug withdrawal hell. I called Gary at 4:30 the next morning and began a hide-and-seek game I played for the next 4 days on the show. I just kept mysteriously calling in sick and refused to answer my phone. By Thursday, my mother and sister, who were getting their information from listening to the show, really started to worry. As I said, these two are the strongest women in my life, and they proved themselves that day once more. My girlfriend Dana was unbelievably strong, too. She knew that something was wrong. Everyone close to me did, I guess. The three of them came to my apartment on Thursday morning while the show was still on and kept banging on the door, demanding to be let in. When I answered it, I had a beard, I was shivering, and I hadn't changed my clothes in days. "Listen," I said, "I've been taking heroin, and I'm trying to kick it here." They had no experience with heroin detox, and neither did I. I knew enough to tell them that I needed some sleeping pills and some whiskey to hold off the real sickness, because at that point I was green. That didn't do much. It gave me a few hours of relief before the withdrawal symptoms started all over again. We talked about how I could get myself in shape without having to drop out of the movie and without going back on heroin. I considered that a pretty big problem to solve, but I had a bigger one that I had to address immediately. When I missed work for the fourth consecutive day and blew off all the movie meetings, the two main money guys started calling, demanding to hear from me. The theories being aired on the show didn't ease their minds any. Was Artie back on coke? Was he holed up in Vegas with a hooker? Was he on a gambling bender somewhere? They needed the truth, so I came clean to Frank Sebastiano, who signed on to direct, and Anthony Mastromoro, the producer. Frank was the first one I let up to my apartment, then Jimmy Palumbo, who'd been my friend for years. All I had to do was open the door for them to see how I was. Frank had put more blood, sweat, and tears into this project than anybody. He wanted to get made every bit as much as I did. But he took one look at me, and that went out the window. "Art, I've known you a long time," he said, "and I never thought I'd see you looking like this." "Yeah, I know, Frank. I've been doing this shit a lot, and it caught up with me. But I'm going to get through it. Art, nobody has the balls to do this, but I'm going to call off the movie." Frank is a real tough kid from Jersey, so when I saw him start crying, I knew it was serious. I started crying too. "Frank, you know how much this means to us." "I do, Art, but we've got to pull a plug," he said. "The only thing that matters is that you get better. I'd rather have you alive than have this movie." Frank's sincerity and compassion moved me as much as Quincy Jones had back at Mad TV. Frank put things in perspective for me. "Art, fuck it," he said. "Fuck the movie. Fuck the money. So people lose money. So maybe you never go back to the Stern Show. If what you've been doing for work has gotten you to this place, none of it's worth it. Don't go back to the Stern Show. Don't do anything. You just do whatever you need to be happy. Because if you're not happy, you're going to do this to yourself and you're going to die." "Frank, no, I can't do this. I want to make the movie. I'm not going to do this to anyone involved. I'm not going to do this to you." "Don't worry about me. Just take care of yourself. I'm going to pull the plug." "Please don't do that yet, Frank," I said. "Just give me the weekend." He talked to our investors, and they called up the next day, a Friday afternoon. "Listen, Art, we're about to write a check for $500,000 to set up the production office for the shoot. You've got to tell us what the fuck is going on. We've put $350,000 in this already, and we need to know what's going on." "I'm really sorry, guys. Listen, I've been going through some shit, but I'll get it together." "You're going through some shit? What kind of shit are you going through, Artie?" They were not pleased at all. "This isn't a joke, man. We need straight answers." "I'll be okay. I'm going to get clean, okay? I've been taking some pills and not get out of control, and I thought I can get off them on my own, but I can't. I tried and I got myself sick, but I'm going to do this the right way. Don't worry." There was a painful and long silence after that. "Artie, we're sorry that you're having drug problems, and we're glad that you're getting yourself together, but this is serious, and so are we. Part of this deal is that you have to be on the show. If you're not back to normal on the show Monday morning, we're pulling the plug." "Listen, man, don't do that. I'm feeling sick, but give me till Monday. I will get back to work," I said. "If I don't do that, whatever money that you put into this, I will personally pay you back, I promise you." "Artie, we can't wait until Monday to see how you're feeling. If you'd come to these meetings, you know that we have a schedule to keep. We have to know right now if you're going to be able to do this. We need to give Anthony a check today for $500,000, because he's got to pay people and get everyone set up, or else we lose our shooting window. You don't understand, Artie. We need you to answer us right now. I paced back and forth in my bedroom, wondering what to do. I was sweating. I was shaky. And I felt like saying no. It seemed impossible to me. But something inside me told me I was wrong. I knew I'd never get over the disappointment. Frank and I had our chance to make the movie we wanted starring me. The pussy thing to do was to say no. Fuck that. I've been in tough spots before. I'd find a way out of it by Monday. I took a deep breath. Write the check, I said. Give it to Anthony. I'm doing this. I will be there Monday morning. Are you sure, Artie? I'm sure. We hope you are, they said. Because if you're not, it's done. The plug will be pulled, and we will cut our losses. I understand. I'll be there Monday. I had no choice but to get it together right away. My mother and sister and I called a few rehab centers to find me a bed where I could detox properly over the weekend. I tried a rehab center in Summit where I'd gone to kick coke 10 years before, and I left a message with the receptionist. Hi, my name is Artie Lang. I'm a comedian who stayed there with you a while ago to kick coke, and I'm wondering if you could help me out this weekend. Sure, what's the problem? I've got to detox from heroin right away. Okay, I'll have someone call you back. The doctor who did, in my opinion, is the hero of this story. He was a huge Stern fan who taped the show every day for years. He was also the singer in a power metal band. His name is Tomaso Skorupski, and when he called me back, he wasn't surprised. He known from listening to the show that I'd been out for 4 days and figured there was a good chance it had to do with drugs. Listen, Artie, there's a drug called Subutex. Have you heard about it? No. It's a miracle drug. It will get you through the withdrawals and make you feel like a human being again. I'm going to get you 6 8-milligram tablets. Cut the 8-milligram tablets in half so you have 4 milligrams, because you don't need the full amount. Do not have anything to drink 10 minutes before you take it. Put it under your tongue and let it dissolve. And once it dissolves, in 25 minutes, you will feel completely normal and all of the withdrawal pains will go away. Does it get you high? No. Craving the high is the whole other problem, and we'll get to that. This won't make you high, it will make you normal. We use this to take away the physical addiction, to get people straight enough to start putting their life together. This is where we start. Okay. You'll stay on this for 6 months. You'll get your life together. And then, under my care, we will get you off of it. He called in the prescription and made a plan to come to my house in 2 days to give me a full physical. My mother and sister were skeptical about allowing me to put more drugs in my body, but I was going to do anything at all to get myself to work on Monday. My sister picked up the Subutex, we cut the tablets in half with a cigar cutter, and I put one under my tongue. It's scary, but 20 minutes later, I felt like I could build a house. The sweating stopped, the shaking stopped. I didn't just feel well, I felt great. I felt like I was flying, completely normal, and high too. If this was detox, I was all for it. I went and shaved for the first time in what felt like 4 months. What a guy. In the year 2005, this fucker made a house call. Skorupski came to my house Sunday night at 7 p.m. to give me my physical, and he asked me how I felt. I really did feel fine. Probably too fine. I suppose knowing that I had the option of detoxing made it seem like less of a big deal than it was. Monday morning, I strolled into the show fresh as a daisy. Thanks to Subutex and Tomaso, my life was saved. But I had a lot of explaining to do. We signed on, and Howard started right in. All right, Artie. Do you want to explain what happened? Look, I had a bad few months on the road. I started drinking too much. I was drinking too much. Way too much, I said. I wasn't doing drugs, just drinking, but I was drinking a lot. You were out for a week. I had a really bad hangover. I had to clean myself up for a few days. No one believed me, and who could blame them? Gary said it to himself. I think someday we'll get the whole story, but if that's what you're saying, that's fine. I got a week of solid ball breaking from every fan who called in, from Howard, from everybody. And then finally it went away, just like another chapter in a show in my fucked up existence. I moved on to do what I had to do for the movie. I went to every meeting, met the wardrobe people, all of it. I signed off on all decisions I needed to as producer and star and co-writer. And on the 4th of July, we started shooting. I never missed a mark or line or day at the Howard Stern Show. We finished the film on time and under budget. On the last day of shooting, I was still not quite sure how I did it. Within a month, my life had turned around from complete darkness to amazing light. Dana was such a big part of me getting through to shooting that even mentioning it here makes me feel guilty that we're not together anymore. She was there every step of the way, holding my hand after every tough scene. She was around the days when I had to shoot for 10 hours and then go to Stern Show the next morning. I had 3 insane weeks and she was with me constantly, massaging my shoulders, talking me through things that were worrying me, whatever I wanted. She was off work for the summer, and I got the producers to pay for her as one of my assistants. I remember one day I looked at the amount of lines I had to memorize and just started crying in the makeup chair. Dana calmed me down, got everyone out of the room, and helped me get through it. Dana was so essential to the success of the film that we gave her a small part in the movie. She plays a friend of my girlfriend's at the diner, and she looks beautiful in it. It's hard for me to see the scene she's in today. I just start crying. If it weren't for Dana, I wouldn't have been able to do my job. But if it weren't for Frank, Anthony, the cinematographer, Dave Phillips, and pros like Ralph Macchio, my buddies Jimmy and Mike Deege, Jerry Miner, Joe Latrullio, Seymour Cassell, and Cara Buono, who played my girlfriend, the movie wouldn't have shined at all. They were fucking great. Not a weak link in the bunch. I dedicated it to Whiskey Talking to Dana, and I should have done the same with Beer League. When we premiered the film at the Ziegfeld Theater in August 2006, we got a distributor deal immediately. Comedy Central saw it and bought it that same night. That's when I felt like I really done something. Walking the red carpet at that legendary theater for a film I starred in and had total creative control over. The fact that the movie destroyed was icing on the cake for me. Everybody from the Stern Show loved it, and so did a lot of people I respect. Colin Quinn called me and said it was the funniest movie he'd seen in 10 years. He said he hadn't laughed that hard in a long time, and I could tell he was genuine. Hey, Richard Roper even gave it a thumbs up. I wasn't expecting that. Beer League is something I'll always be proud of for so many reasons. I might have taken myself to the edge and almost lost it all, but in the 9th inning, I pulled it out. I couldn't have done it alone, and what I learned most of all was that I was surrounded by people who cared about me. I'm lucky that way, and I know not everyone is. I'm the kind of guy who keeps things in, who likes to go it alone, who doesn't like to ask anyone for help. I like to take care of everything myself, because I think I know best. My best might not be a good idea, but it's mine. But this episode of my life changed that point of view, because I couldn't bullshit myself anymore. My way wasn't working. I needed help from people in my life. I had to ask for it, and they were there for me. Sometimes your guardian angels aren't just in heaven. They're all around you if you know where to look. When I see a guy in the streets of Manhattan who appears to be a homeless junkie, I never see him as just some bum loser. I see him as a reflection of myself because I could easily be him. The only difference between us is that I have a great family and friends around me, and most likely he does not. Now, if I were to find out that he ended up that way in spite of having a great family and friends around him, I'd be the first to throw a lit M80 at him, which I'd follow up with the following soliloquy. Fuck you, you lazy junkie bum loser. Why don't you fuck off and die? The next time I see a guy like that, I may actually go ask him a little bit about his life. And if I get the chance, I'll definitely take it. Compassion is fine, but I have to admit, judging and making fun of people who are less fortunate than me is a lot more fun.
Greetings from sunny Kandahar. Not too long ago, I caught a documentary on cable called Patriot Act that was made by Jeff Ross, a comedian I've known for about 15 years. Most people probably know him from the brilliant job he's done on Comedy Central's roasts. I worked with him on the roasts of Hugh Hefner and William Shatner for Comedy Central, as well as the roasts of Donald Trump and Pat Cooper at the Friars Club in New York City. Jeff is always great in that atmosphere, but this documentary showed a whole different side of him. The filmmakers followed Jeff on a trip to Iraq to do stand-up for the troops with a group that was headlined by Drew Carey. It was really well done, and it brought you right there. It got me thinking about the many things we tend to forget living in a country as great as ours. One of those is the simple fact that we are at war, and for the past 5 years, thousands of brave American men and women have been risking their lives in the Middle East, fighting for the good old US of A. Whether you agree with the war or not, as a citizen of this country, you got to support our soldiers. By now, I think most people would agree that we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, but we did, and now that we're there, we have to support the troops in their efforts. Otherwise, our soldiers are dying for nothing. Personally, I think we've got to pray as hard as we can that we get this thing in Iraq done as quickly as possible so our troops in Afghanistan can get the help they desperately need. Winning in Afghanistan is the only thing that can ensure that something like 9/11 never happens again here or anywhere else in the West. Afghanistan is where the terrorists are, not Iraq. Of course, that sounds like the naive ramblings of a schoolboy, but there's one fact that no one can deny. It's a fucking mess over there, and our brave countrymen are in the thick of it. The only thing that makes me feel better about that fact is the knowledge that if anyone is capable of figuring out the best course of action, it's the men and women in our armed forces that I met over there. They amazed me every single day. Excuse my brief political rant. I promise that's all you're going to hear from me as far as politics goes. I'm not exactly qualified to run for office, so believe me, I know when to keep shit to myself. Anyway, getting back to how I ended up in a desert in 120-degree heat during wartime, Ross's documentary really affected me to the point that I became obsessed with the idea of going over there to entertain the troops in one way or another. These are extraordinary times, much like any time of war is, and I wanted to do my part as so many people do. I feel privileged to possess a talent for comedy, which is badly needed over there, believe me. I know it sounds like show business bullshit, but my desire to go really had nothing to do with good PR. I just wanted to help. I know exactly why, too. My grandfather, Sal Caprio, fought in the army in World War II and was a true war hero, although he was very humble about it. He never made a lot of money in his life, but that doesn't mean a thing. If I'm lucky, one day I'll be half the man Sal Caprio was. The worst shrink in the world could deduce that my desire to serve my country by doing stand-up for the troops was my attempt to make him proud of me. Sal's been dead for 14 years, but believe me, that's the correct assessment, no doubt about it. I was determined to do it, so the next step was figuring out how to do it. In September 2007, I called my stand-up agent at the time, Conan Smith, to get the ball rolling. Conan is a rare creature in the agent world. He is both very bright and he understands how to deal with someone of my unique mindset. In other words, he knows how to handle comedians with unbelievably self-destructive loser tendencies. Conan foresaw some trouble with this scheme of mine. "Well, Art, I know who to call because I've done this before," he said. "But you might be what I'd call a risk. Your record isn't exactly clean." After a few weeks with no word from Conan, I called him to check in and heard the news I expected. It didn't look good. It seemed that the people at the USO did something that has become my kryptonite in recent years. They Googled me. People Googling Artie Lang has cost me jobs, health insurance, and that first time, the chance to fulfill my dream of entertaining the troops. Not to get all Unabomber on you, and I did promise I was done with politics, but to me, certain types of technology are the fucking devil. One simple web search provided the USO with my history with drugs and the law in startling detail, and they told Conan all about it. What a wacko time we're living in. 20 years ago, if you wanted to run a background check on someone, you had to hire a talented, well-connected private investigator. Now all you need are parents who make enough money to buy their shithead kid a fucking computer. For a guy with a background like mine, Google is the worst noun that could be used as a verb, besides Jew. The USO knew that I had a history as a drug addict and that I'd been arrested before, and they felt that I wasn't exactly the ideal candidate to head up one of their comedy tours. Conan put it to me this way: "Art, they're pretty skeptical about you." My personal history mistakes weren't my only problems. I'd heard a rumor that Sirius Satellite Radio had wanted to bring the entire Howard Stern Show cast to Iraq to do a few weeks of live shows. It would have been amazing. Now that's what I call a huge publicity stunt. To say that the Howard Stern Show is beloved by a lot of our troops is one of the understatements of the century. Having the show broadcast live from Iraq would definitely bring a lot of cheer, but it didn't happen because the USO had its reservations about the show and were particularly concerned with Howard's tendency to be completely honest. Honesty in wartime is not always considered the best policy by those in charge. Add to that the show's usual subject matter and a regular list of taboos that are broken on a daily basis, and you have a clear reason why the Stern Show was turned down. Unfortunately, as a representative of the show, I probably would have been turned down too, even without my fucked up background. The strikes against me were just too big. But I wasn't going to leave it that way. I was determined to turn the situation around, and the irony was I figured I could use the Stern Show, the biggest strike against me, to help resurrect my dream. I went on the air and I told Howard how I'd been turned down to entertain the troops because of the show and my sketchy background. I hadn't wanted to make a big deal about it at all. I just wanted to go and quietly do a tour during one of our vacations, but now I had no choice. "I'm a little aggravated," I said. I think that I probably have some fans over there in the military who would enjoy the show I'd put together. So if there's anybody out there who can help the situation, I'm putting it out there. I'm annoyed. You know what? This is really horrible, Howard said. I know a lot of soldiers love the show. They love Artie. And hey, if Artie wants to do his part, I don't see any reason why this shouldn't happen. Sure enough, about a month later, my agent, Conan, called me and said that the USO had called. After I brought it up on the air, quite a few soldiers had expressed an interest in seeing me perform. The USO did the right thing. They came back to us and okayed it, but they were going to pay strict attention to who I wanted to bring over with me. They were also going to require that I get a note from a doctor saying that I was healthy and drug-free. The last thing they wanted, and who could blame them, was for me to go through heroin withdrawal over there. This was great news. I had a physical, and the doctor sent them a note saying that I was in good enough shape to make the trip. He assured them that I was not doing heroin. I promised them that if I wasn't clean, I wouldn't get on the plane. A woman named Tracy Theed at the USO, who is a very big deal over there as well as being a very professional, nice, and confident woman, got on the phone with me in April 2008 and in no uncertain terms laid out what I was getting myself into. By that time, my agent had left the world of stand-up agenting, much to my chagrin. Like a lot of the bright agents, Conan Smith went to work as an executive at a production company to produce TV shows and short films. I hoped to work with him in the future. Even though Conan had made this move, he graciously agreed to remain the point man on the tour as one of the last things he would do as an agent. "We got the note from your doctor, and that's great," Tracy said. "The conditions are hotter or rougher than you can imagine, so as long as you're confident that it won't be a problem, we are fine on that requirement." "No, that won't be a problem at all. I expect that," I said. "Now tell me who you intend to take over," she said. I began to lay out my dream team for her. Jimmy Florentine and Nick DiPaolo, who are both great friends and greater comedians, were first on the list. The rest I was going to have to think about. One of the USO stipulations was their right to censor certain material. We weren't to talk about anything homosexual or obviously offensive to women or disparaging of marriage or relationships or do drug-related humor. Not even anything on masturbation. I yesed my way through that speech, figuring that we could probably get away with it once we were over there. I figured it would be hard to take the mic out of my hand if I was able to get a crowd of guys laughing who'd just taken fire from the enemy. Even if it was a fag joke. But on one point, there was absolutely no uncertainty. We could not make fun of President Bush. "He is the commander-in-chief," Tracy said. "He leads the armed forces. This will not be tolerated at all." "That will not be a problem. I completely understand. This is serious. Other comics have wavered from this, and they were not welcome back." "Okay, I will be sure that everyone involved is well aware of this." I wasn't surprised. I figured that politics and religion were going to be huge no-nos. Religion and politics were two of the reasons we were at war. Who could expect to take that stuff lightly? Jimmy Florentine and Nick DiPaolo, besides being great talents, are guys and not very political in their comedy, so I didn't see a problem. They're the kind of guys soldiers, both men and women, would love. And I don't think they mind me saying that they're not known by anyone to be ultra-liberals. Neither am I, for that matter. The chances of any of us doing a lot of political anti-Bush stuff was nil. They were okayed, and they signed on immediately, eager to help out their country, as I was. I needed one more guy, and I wanted it to be a friend of mine. My dream guy at that point was Colin Quinn, who was one of my heroes as a comedian. He really wanted to go, but the USO had an issue with him. I never got an official reason. He had done several USO tours before, and the soldiers loved him, but the USO must have felt he'd crossed a line. It could have been a president joke, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, Conan Smith tried his best, but the USO wasn't going to budge, so I had to give up on that idea. While I was trying to decide which comedian friend I'd take, Gary Delabate, Baba Booey from The Stern Show, stepped up and said he wanted to come. "I realize I don't do stand-up, but I'd like to come and introduce you guys," he said. "I'd like to be kind of a host." Gary is really good at this. I'd seen him do it on the road. He tells a couple of minutes of jokes, he MCs, and he's good at introducing the show to the crowd. He really wanted to give back to the soldiers in any way he could. I thought it was wonderful. The only issue I had was that he didn't fit one of the criteria I'd set for every member of this tour. Gary had children. He's got a beautiful wife, a beautiful house in Connecticut, and two great little boys, one 12 and one 10. I really had an issue with this because I would not be able to live with myself if something happened to him over there. Especially if something happened to all of us and I lived, that is. Gary understood this, so he went home one day and talked it over with his wife, who said it was cool. He explained to his kids that their father was going to help the country, so they thought it was cool too, and since he really wanted to do it, that was it. Now let me just state for the record that I love Gary, and I always have. There was some controversy on the show, there always is, about whether or not I really wanted his company. That was never an issue for me. The only issue was that he had kids. After I got over that, though, I was really happy that he was coming. Gary was a bonus. With him hosting and moving the show along, the rest of us could just deal with making the troops laugh. Florentine, DiPaolo, Gary, and myself, a good start, but we still needed one more comic. The great Greg Fitzsimmons went through my mind, but Greg has a child. Bob Levy, too, is a guy the soldiers would love, but Bobby has a 9-year-old, so he was out of the question. I wasn't sure what I was going to do until it just kind of happened. For the fourth time in the past 6 years, I did a benefit that Greg Fitzsimmons puts together in New York City. About 11 years ago, Jerry Red Wilson, a comedian he and I knew, died of spinal meningitis at 36 years old. He was a great, gregarious guy from Queens who died right when everything was going right for him. He had a fiance who he'd proposed to on The Tonight Show, and he was making a real name for himself. He had his own short-lived sitcom, but it was obvious that he was going to do other sitcom work. Anyone who saw him knew that Jerry Red Wilson was going to be a very successful comic. Right after his girlfriend agreed to marry him, she and Jerry flew to Hawaii so he could appear in an episode of the new Fantasy Island series. He went, he did his thing, but while he was there, he got very sick with what turned out to be spinal meningitis. His condition got dramatically worse very quickly, and he slipped into a coma even before his fiance could get him to the hospital. He died soon after. Every year for the past 10 years, his fiance and Greg Fitzsimmons have held a benefit to support the Jerry Red Wilson Foundation, which helps raise awareness about spinal meningitis and funds research for a cure. I'm happy to say that his fiance is now married and very happy, and over the years the benefit has grown tremendously. It started out at Caroline's, but as of 3 years ago, it has become big enough to sell out the 1,100-seat Town Hall Theater. I did the benefit in 2008 while still looking for my last comic, and that's where I found him. Another guy who always does the show is arguably, along with Nick DiPaolo, one of the best comedians of the last 20 years. He's one of the nicest guys and has been a friend of mine for a long time. I'm in awe of this guy's talent, as many are when it comes to club comedy. His name is Dave Attell. Mainstream audiences know him as the host of the great Comedy Central show Insomniac, and now he's hosting the new Gong Show on the channel too. But nothing can come close to capturing the unique experience of seeing Dave Attell in his element at a New York comedy club on, say, a Thursday night with a full room. Dave getting up to do a 20-minute set is unequaled. In that environment, there is no other comedian I'd rather see, and that includes Richard Pryor and George Carlin. I know that's a pretty emphatic statement to make, but it's true, and I think a lot of comics would agree. You gotta believe me on this one, and if you get the chance, go find out for yourself. If you were going to erect a Mount Rushmore dedicated to the greatest comedians of the last 20 years, DiPaolo and Attell would be your Washington and Lincoln. Anyway, when I saw Attell at the Jerry Red Wilson benefit, he said to me, "Hey man, I hear you're putting together a troupe to go do stand-up for the troops." "Definitely," I said. "Man, I've been a bunch of times," Dave said, "and I'd like to do it with you. Do you mind if I'm part of it?" "Are you fucking kidding me?" "No, are you sure?" "Yeah, I'm sure." The next day I called Conan Smith very excited to tell him that Attell wanted to do it. In my mind, this was it. Gary hosting, Jimmy Florentine, Nick DiPaolo, Dave Attell, and myself. There wasn't a more heavenly lineup on earth for guys and chicks who were soldiers. It was definitely my dream team. I had put this thing together, so the USO asked that I name the tour. On a conference call with Conan and Tracy Thede, I said as a goof, "How about Operation Mirth?" It sounded kind of ironic since mirth is an old-fashioned word that means gaiety and fun, which is not quite what any of our team is known for. I said it as a joke. Tracy giggled on the phone, and before I knew it, there were flyers and shirts and hats going around that said, "Artie Lang's Operation Mirth." "There's just one thing you have to understand," Tracy said. "You can mention the tour on the air and you can mention who is going, but you are going to Afghanistan. You are going to the shit. You are not going to Iraq. You're not going to Baghdad and having a nice little trip. You're going out to obscure bases with only about 80 guys in them. Places with special ops, bases that never see shows." If I hadn't picked up on the vibe that we weren't exactly Robin Williams or Billy Crystal, that comment did it. "Well, that's great. We want to help," I said. "These soldiers are going to love you so much just for showing up," Tracy said. "Before you go on stage, they'll give you a hug. But it's going to be a little dangerous, Artie. If you're okay with it, we'll send you to Afghanistan, but on the air, please just say that you're going to Iraq. We don't want people knowing that you're going there, and we don't want them to know the exact time either." We were scheduled to go from June 28th to July 4th, 2008, which worked out perfectly. It was the first week of our 2-week vacation from Howard, so neither Gary nor I would have to miss a day of work. As the date drew closer, I got more and more nervous, and it was only a matter of time before I fell off the wagon again with heroin. Bad. One night, weeks before, while I was shooting pool in this bar billiards league, what some of you might call the wrong crowd showed up. They're definitely the wrong crowd for me, because that night I fell off the wagon, headfirst into a heroin binge that would last for several months. But I'd made a promise to the USO, So I had to force myself to stop doing heroin and get myself together. Subutex once again did the job. When it was time to roll on June 28th, I was allowed to take some Subutex with me, and I was feeling well enough to get on the plane. It was tough, believe me, but maybe some higher power helped me out. Of the many times I've needed an extra helping hand, this was one of them. That USO tour had become the single most important event in my career. Our first leg was Newark to Frankfurt, Germany, a flight that Jimmy Florentine and I took together. We were supposed to meet up with the other guys in Frankfurt, but they were delayed. We spent our time with Jeff Anthony, an amazing Vietnam vet who was our USO guide and manager throughout the trip. From Frankfurt, we took a flight to Istanbul. Luckily, these first few legs were all commercial flights that we did in business class. There was a chance that DiPaolo, Attell, and Gary might not meet us. If that was the case, Jeff informed us that we'd have to keep moving forward and that Jim and I might be responsible for doing all of the shows by ourselves until they caught up. But fortunately, the others made it to Istanbul on time. Next, we flew to Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, where we slept on our first army base. The arrangements were not nearly as bad as I thought they'd be. We stayed in a pretty clean, big army barracks. We showered, slept, and got ready for our first engagement. One show for the entire base. The first show was at 7 p.m., and it was packed. Standing room only, a great turnout. There were about 800 people in a room that was meant to hold 600. We got the butterflies out during that show and found out what was cool to say and what wasn't. Because it was a tour I'd set up, I was the headliner, so I had to close. Let me tell you, following Jim Florentine, DiPaolo, and Attell is no easy feat anywhere, and sitting there watching them perform that first time, I realized that it was going to be rough. That turned out to be a great thing because it kept me focused on delivering the best set I could. Between that pressure and the Subutex, I felt great and had no heroin cravings. I had bigger fish to fry. Gary took the stage, told a few jokes, and made the necessary announcements. Then Florentine did about 15 to 20 minutes. Nick did the same, Attell did about the same, and then me. I was contracted to do 30, 35 minutes. Jimmy, God bless him, tore down all the taboos that first night. Everybody respected the band on religious humor and didn't do anything anti-Bush, but starting with Jimmy at that very first show, we all did every other thing the USO had asked us not to do, and we could not have killed any harder. I looked at Jeff Anthony, thinking that this would be our first and last show. As long as nobody complains, you got nothing to worry about, he said. And judging by how hard they are laughing, I don't think anybody's about to complain. Jimmy did sex stuff and amazing stuff about relationships, and they all loved it. In our defense, we weren't completely blatant about it. We made an effort to get around the rules, with humor, of course. Our approach was best summed up by this joke Dave Attell told during his very first set. When we signed up for this tour, they said, you can't do any jokes about masturbation, he said. So let me tell you a story about the time I was fucking a sock with shampoo in it. I killed two, but there were a couple of lulls because I decided to tackle another taboo subject that nobody else had, racial comedy. Basically, it was stupid material that I loved doing because it causes uptight white people to panic. That night, I brought out gems like this one. If Santa Claus was black, there would be some problems. I don't think you could convince rednecks that once a year a black guy was going to break into their house late at night and leave them shit. The next morning, we took our first true military flight. We walked into one of those huge planes that hold 500 soldiers, the type where the bottom of the plane drops down like a big ramp. I walked up into it thinking about the scene in Close Encounters of the Third Kind when the aliens come down a similar kind of thing. We took our seats, five out-of-shape comedians sitting up in front with 500 men and women in the Marines, Army, and Air Force behind us ready to roll. These soldiers were not only in great shape, but they were young, kids in their 20s with 60 pounds of equipment on their backs. They were unbelievably heroic, ready to serve our country, and were so appreciative that we were there that I was incredibly moved. There was a smoking hot chick, also about 20, from Texas, who served as sort of our flight attendant, except that unlike your average hot young flight attendant, she was smart, tough, and military through and through. We knew her only by her nickname, Worm. She was really hot, and on the 3-hour flight to Afghanistan, Jeff Anthony, our USO manager, could see that we all really liked her. I'm sure she could see it too, because our tongues were cartoonishly hanging out of our mouths. I couldn't help myself. I kept asking her to get up and get me more water, because that meant she'd have to bend over in front of us. She was clearly in better shape than all of us combined and could definitely kick our asses, but getting her to bend over for water was worth it. I was willing to risk the beating. I don't mind admitting that I jerked off to her that night with Dave Attell sleeping just 8 feet away from me in our room. I never told Dave, and you might think I'm crazy for putting it in this audiobook, but I'm not. I know Dave, and there's no way in hell he's ever going to listen to this. Anyway, we landed in Kandahar, and let me tell you, that place was unique. We'd been warned by the soldiers at the base we just left, but honestly, no one can prepare you for the extra special environmental eccentricities that await you when you touch down in Kandahar. The place literally tastes and smells like shit. You see, that's because there's a shit pond, literally a reservoir of shit, in the middle of Kandahar. Every day around 6 p.m. when the wind blows just right, which luckily for us was when we were scheduled to start the second of our 4 outdoor shows, the air transforms into invisible shit. I'll say it again. Nothing can prepare you for it. Right in the middle of Nick DiPaolo's set, I breathed in and it tasted like I was biting into a steaming loaf of shit. This wasn't pleasant, of course, but it did give us a heap of great material. All of us were experiencing it for the first time, which was funny for the soldiers, who'd had no choice but to get used to it. All kidding aside, it was so bad that I almost threw up. I wasn't sure I'd be able to make it onto the stage. I started thinking about what jokes I could make that involved throwing up, because as I saw it, there was like a 70% chance that I was going to vomit. Somehow I got through it. One of the best laughs I got came when I put a lit cigarette into my nose and coughed out the smoke. That was the only way I could handle the shit wind. After every show on the tour, we did a meet and greet in a separate location where everyone who'd seen the show and everyone on the base could come and shake our hands and have us sign these Operation Mirth posters or whatever else they wanted signed. Those were my favorite moments, getting to talk to the troops one-on-one. On the way to the meet and greet one night, 20 yards into the drive, an ear-splitting siren went off, followed by an announcement. Mortar fire coming in. Take cover immediately. Mortar fire coming in. Take cover immediately. Without flinching, the driver pulled the big Hummer we were riding in over to the side of the road and told us not to move. A bunch of Marines, white and black, men and women, got us out of the truck and formed human shields around us. They walked us forward toward this above-ground bunker where we were going to wait this thing out because the base was under attack. "Hey, man," I said to Chris, one of the black kids, "should we be worrying our asses off right now?" "Artie," he said, "the way I look at it like this. Don't stress it. If one of these motherfucking mortars hits you, you're going to be vaporized. You won't feel a goddamn thing, man, because you're going to be dust. In your case, you're going to be a lot of dust, but you're going to be dust all the same. You know what? If that happens, I'm going to have to sweep that shit up, so I hope it doesn't, because you're going to be a lot of dust if you get vaporized, man. I wish you weighed a few less pounds, man, just in case you get hit. You would be one hell of a cleanup job, Artie. A hell of a lot of dust." "Okay, I get it," I said, not really laughing because I was experiencing true fear. "Enough with the dust joke." "Okay, man, just look at it this way, Artie. If one of them doesn't hit you, then everything is cool. If you don't get hit, in a few minutes it's back to normal, everything's fine." "Yeah, but what if one of them comes close? What if there's some shrapnel?" This kid looked at me dead serious. "Artie, if that happens, me and my partner here will make sure you won't be touched. We'll take the hit." I'll never forget this. Here was a guy saying he'd throw himself in front of mortar fire to save my life just because I'm an American citizen. It doesn't get more real than that. I'm a piece of shit, out of shape comedian. This guy's life means way more than mine does over there. But this Chris was willing to take that hit for me. And he was a black kid. The next time I hear somebody saying racist shit, I'm going to punch him in the fucking face. Actually, that's not true. I'll want to punch him in the face, but I'll probably pussy out and not do it and agree with the fucking racist shit they're saying so I don't get my ass kicked. But secretly, I'll be disagreeing with them. I love black people, believe me, even more so now because one of them almost saved my life. But I fully intend to continue being the pussy that I am. Sorry, Chris. Anyway, these guys got us to the bunker and the attack continued for the next 40 minutes. This structure was very claustrophobic, like an above-ground coffin made of concrete, about 7 feet tall and 10 feet wide and open at both ends. We were able to stand in it, but just barely. Manute Bol would have been fucked. We all sat in the interior of this thing, and we got great pictures of all of us in there looking pretty scared. Once we got the all clear, they let us go. And that's when I understood what day-to-day life was like for these troops. We continued with the regularly scheduled program. We did the meet and greet and signed pictures for a while, and carried on as if nothing had happened. The next day, through some leaks in my agent's office or publicist's office or some people working for the Army or USO, Russia Malloy and the Daily News ran pictures of Gary and me and an item about the mortar attack. We didn't find out about it until Nick DiPaolo called home on a satellite phone that Jimmy Florentine had gotten from his brother before he left. Nick's wife was crying, thinking that it had been even worse than the paper let on. I just talked to my mother and sister a few days before, so when I got a chance to use the phone, I called my great, beautiful friend Michelle in Florida, another one of the guardian angels in my life. When I found out that I wouldn't be able to make another call on the satellite phone because it would only last for short periods of time, I asked her to call my mother and sister to tell them I was fine. The next day, we were going to a very remote place that I'm not allowed to name to do another show. We were told this was where the troops were really going to dig us. To get there, we had to take Black Hawk helicopters and we had to wear flak jackets and bulletproof vests. They had to sew three together to fit me, which was a great ego boost and the big joke of the trip. Jeff Anthony showed us how to put them on, and off we went. If you ever have the chance to wear a flak jacket, don't. They are fucking uncomfortable. We did our show, and we're about to get on another helicopter to go to an even more remote base. I couldn't imagine what that was going to be like, because where we were, there were only about 80 guys who just returned from doing hand-to-hand combat with the Taliban. I shit you not. Those guys thanked us up and down for making the trip, and when I told them where we were going next, these guys who just faced off with the Taliban couldn't believe it. Where we were was dangerous enough for them. To get to the next location, we were required to have two Apache helicopters as an escort in addition to the armed Black Hawk helicopters. In the end, we couldn't go because the Apaches had mechanical problems. Considering that there are two huge guns on each Black Hawk, the fact that we wouldn't be allowed to attempt the trip without the backup of two Apaches, hardcore armored Apaches, said it all. That fourth show had to be canceled. Instead, we booked a meet and greet within driving distance of Kandahar and returned there by helicopter. Two good old boys flew the Blackhawks, and another two good old boys manned the guns in back. They were positioned on the outer sides of the copter, scanning the Afghani desert, looking for Taliban who come out of water holes or just appear out of the desert from these little tents and caves. These guys had enormous M60s, and they'd shoot at anything suspicious. When we got over the desert, one of the kids turned to me. "Hey, Artie, you want to shoot the fucker?" "Yeah, I'd love to." "Come over here, man." All the soldiers who took us around did a lot of subtle fat jokes with me, and this guy was no different. "First, I gotta climb over you. The war may be over by the time I do it, but I'm gonna have to climb over you." Once he got over me, he said, "Okay, man, I'm gonna give you the gun, and I want you to aim for that mountain." I aimed for the mountain, which I assumed wasn't going to be a very difficult thing to hit, but it was. I swear to God, I came nowhere fucking near it. A mountain. I didn't care. Shooting that thing was great. I fucking lost it. I had so much fun shooting this huge M60 out of a Black Hawk helicopter in the middle of the Afghani desert, I couldn't believe it. I was like some drunken cowboy just blasting away at a section of the desert with an amazing history. It was almost inappropriate. Our pilots pointed out ruins as we flew over, long bits of a wall that looked like a pile of rubble. That pile used to be one of Alexander the Great's castles, and there I was, shooting and missing the huge mountain just beyond it. After 2 minutes, the kid had to cut me off. "All right, Artie, calm down," he said. "Calm down, we're gonna run out of ammo." Hey man, that was fun. I could see that. "Hey, you said that the Taliban runs out of nowhere all the time. What if I accidentally killed a Taliban guy just now?" The kid turned and looked out into the sun and the sand and then turned back to me and he said, "Well, Artie, if you did, that's one less fucker I gotta kill." He started maniacally laughing, and as I enjoyed my own fantasy camp moment from Platoon, Apocalypse Now, and every other great war movie I've ever seen, I started maniacally laughing with him as if we'd gone through basic training together. We landed back at the base, got reacquainted with the cool breeze of the shit pond, and the next day we were driven to a base about an hour outside of Kandahar, where we did a meet and greet, had dinner with the guys, talked, and took pictures. They hugged us and thanked us for coming. You could tell how much it was appreciated, which made the experience rewarding on a very personal level. I gave a lot of the guys I met there my phone number and offered to give them a tour of the Sirius studio when they got back. I've seen a few of them back here already. Right now I'm trying to get another kid Yankee tickets for next year, and despite the trip being over, I will do anything I can to keep in contact. I have that much respect for these kids. After that last visit, we returned to Kandahar, showered, and were all set to get our first of a few planes home. We were supposed to be back by July 4th to have dinner with our families and enjoy the holiday, which, considering what we'd just done, would definitely be meaningful. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. We were cargo and military flights, which weren't exactly a priority, so we kept getting delayed. Show business people get their ass kissed in the States, but over there a piece of toilet paper being delivered to the soldiers had more pull than we did when it came to getting one of those flights. We waited for a full day after we'd been told the next plane was ours. We played cards, we killed time, but 20 hours in a terminal in an army airport in Bagram, Afghanistan, offers little entertainment or distraction after an hour, let alone 20. In the end, we got out, but we missed the last flight out of Kyrgyzstan. When that happened, we officially weren't going to make it home for the 4th, and I wasn't happy about that at all. My mother had planned a whole big party down at my shore house. I was looking forward to my mother's sausage and fried peppers and bread and pasta, and I'll admit it, I lost it in the Kyrgyzstan airport. I threw shit around, I yelled, and I just got out of control. Everyone around me, who didn't exactly speak great English, looked at me like I was insane. Dave Attell, Gary, Florentine, and Jeff Anthony had to calm me down, and thank God I was surrounded by friends because they were the only reason I didn't get arrested. I know one thing for sure. If I had been arrested, I'd still be in a Kyrgyzstan jail right now. My friends kept the authorities from taking me away, and somehow they got me to relax a bit. We weren't going anywhere, so the Army sent transport to take us back to the base until the next day. I'd had it, and as I'm known to do, which you obviously know if you've gotten this far, I looked around for some self-destructive relief. Gambling was out of the question, since I wasn't interested in Kyrgyz horse and cart racing, and every woman in the vicinity who looked like a whore seemed like she'd last seen youth back when there was a czar in office. That left chemical relief, and drastic measures were necessary. I told my friends I needed a stiff drink to chill out, so I went to this dinky little bar in the airport and ordered a double Jack Daniels. As I chugged it and ordered another, I saw a shady-looking guy sitting there eyeballing me. I knew right away what the deal with him was. I started talking to the bartender very loudly about where I could buy Valium or some other drug, and sure enough, this guy came right over. I bought 15 Valium off the guy and took 12 of them right there in one swallow of whiskey. That did it all right. Suddenly, this bare-bones airport lounge was completely interesting to me. By the time we got back to the Army base, I was so fucked up that I was slurring my words and yelling at people for no reason at all. I tried to start fights with Gary and the other guys, all of whom are dear friends of mine. I was inventing stuff that they'd done that I was pissed about. I was just this valiumed-up, fucked-up asshole who wanted to be rebellious, just like the douchebag I am. "Look, man," Jeff Anthony said to me as we went through the gates, "we are on a military base. You are way too fucked up to be here right now, my friend. You're going to get arrested if you don't watch yourself." Jeff and the guys put me into what I'd call a gentle headlock and got me to bed, and thank God I passed out. I slept for 20 hours, and when I woke up, had only about 2 hours to kill until our plane ride home. Crisis barely averted, but averted nonetheless. We caught our plane to Istanbul, where we had to bribe some guy $35 to get exit visas. $35? What kind of pathetic bribe is that? It was such a scam, our visas were fine. This guy in the airport said they were not fine, but for $35 they could be fine. Whatever. We slipped in the money and got the right visas. Then we flew out, had a 2-hour layover in Frankfurt, and then flew to New York City direct for 9 hours. I was in business class with Jimmy Florentine again, and we watched Shine a Light, the Scorsese documentary about the 2007 Stones concert at the Beacon Theater in New York City. We watched it about 3 straight times, actually, and had fun bullshitting. Before that trip, I thought I knew everything there was to know about Florentine, but I was wrong. We got to know each other a little bit better, and I'm glad for it. It was such a successful trip. Now that we're home, I feel like I have a bond with those guys that will never be broken. When we landed, Gary and I still had 6 days of vacation to get ourselves together. But the best part was that Jeff Anthony told us right there in the airport that he'd spoken to Tracy Thied, who reported that they'd already gotten such amazing feedback and that the USO was unbelievably happy with the turnout. She called the tour a smashing success and said that we could return anytime we wanted. Everyone said that we'd go back together or on our own. I'm so proud of that. I really, really am. A couple of weeks later, I got a letter from Edward A. Powell, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the USO. "Dear Artie, thank you for participating in your recent tour to Kyrgyzstan and Afghanistan and for taking the time to honor the men and women serving there. It meant so much to them, and it reminded them that the USO supports them and their families wherever they serve. We look forward to future USO tours with you and wish you the very best. With kind regards, Edward A. Powell." That was a beautiful letter to get. It's displayed nicely on my refrigerator, so I'll see it all the time. Of all the fun things I've done in my career, I'm most proud of my USO tour. My grandfather was a real war hero, and obviously, I'm no hero, except when I'm trying to save drunken white trash girls in taxicabs, but that's another story. I'm just glad that I possess a skill that enabled me to fulfill my dream. Despite a life of bad decisions that almost made it impossible, I ended up being asked to head up another tour almost the moment I touched down back home. It's nothing I'd ever take for granted, but when I stop to think about it, which I'm doing right now, that kind of fucked up shit is just what happens to me. That kind of fucked up shit, both the good and the bad, is the story of my life. I'm glad to be ending this audiobook on a positive note, which is rare but not impossible for me. But before I do, I need to say one more thing on the subject of our troops. When they start coming back, we cannot let this episode in our history mirror what happened after the Vietnam War. We cannot make the same mistake twice. Bob Costas did a great interview with Bruce Dern, an actor who was in the film Coming Home, which is about how Vietnam vets were treated in America after the war. At the end of the movie, Bruce Dern's character feels such a sense of guilt about what he did in the war and whatever else he saw that fucked him up over there that he takes off his Marine uniform and runs into the ocean. He commits suicide. in this interview with Costas about the film, Bruce Dern said, "You know what? Whatever you feel about the 60s and Vietnam and Nixon and drugs, whatever else you think about that era, there's one thing everybody has to agree with. There should have been somebody there, supplied by the government or connected to the government in some way, to help guys like the character I played. They should have been there to put their arms around him and say, 'You don't have to kill yourself. What happened over there is not your fault.' The character represents just one of the thousands who did that, but they weren't in a movie. I've been thinking about that film ever since I came back. We might not be prepared to deal with the kind of baggage these young kids will bring back from Iraq. When these American guys and girls from all backgrounds and races and of all ages come back to live among us again, no matter what the outcome of the crazy bullshit over there, our government has to provide some kind of outlet, some kind of expert who will throw their arms around these brave men and women and ask them how they feel about everything they've been through. These kids are going to need an outlet if they hope to lead normal lives. I hope that every single one of them comes home feeling like a hero, because that's what they are, and they must be treated that way. If the government is too fucked up to do it, I'm saying it now, we have to do it on our own. Every single one of us, as citizens who live here and lead lives untouched by the hell that rages on over there, must do our part. We should go right up to these vets from Iraq and Afghanistan and say, 'Thank you. We love you. How are you feeling?' I'm hoping that maybe they'll say something like this: 'Listen, it's okay. It wasn't easy over there, but we did what we had to do. We served, we risked our lives, and we did the best we could.' And when they do reveal their hardships, I hope it's nothing quite like this: 'I was feeling fine about things, to tell you the truth, until Artie got political again in that motherfucking book of his. I picked that shit up to hear about his fucked up life, and that asshole kept reminding me of the shit I'm trying to forget. Doesn't that douchebag know we don't need to hear from a guy like him? Jesus Christ, how about telling a couple of dick jokes, Tubby?' To our troops, I'd like to say this now: you're right, and I'm sorry. The third time is a charm, and it won't happen again. At least not in this audiobook. Because as of now, this audiobook is fucking over. You'll hear no more politics or anything else out of my fat jerk-off Jersey mouth. I promise you. Until next time, that is. Salud!"
The last word. As I finished writing this book, another drug-related problem came up once again in my life. It's too complicated a story to tell briefly, but put it this way. If I get a second book deal, it's going to be one hell of a good place to start. People always say to me, "Thank God you're in a business that is very forgiving when it comes to drug addicts." They say, "Look at Robert Downey Jr. That guy had a horrible problem with drug addiction. He was getting so fucked up he was passing out in strangers' houses, going to sleep in their kids' beds. He kept fucking up chance after chance. Now he's one of the biggest movie stars in the world." Well, that might be true, but these people tend to forget one very important piece of that puzzle. Not everyone is Robert Downey Jr. Yes, the guy had a tremendous problem with drugs, but he's also got tremendous acting talent. Show business is a business. In fact, it's more business than it is show. And it's a business that's not very forgiving of those who don't bring in money. Drug addicts with talent, who are good earners, are good business, so they're forgiven. You can't let your drug problem get bigger than your talent or marketability, because something very different happens to you then. Unfortunately, that is the norm, not the exception. For every Robert Downey Jr., there are 100 Jeff Conaways out there. Before I sign off, I'd just like to say, if you enjoyed this audiobook at all, if maybe you found something in these words that gave you a chuckle or caused an eye to tear or taught you a lesson about what not to do, tell a friend about it. Don't give them your audiobook, please. That's a bad idea. I hope you found at least one story in here that you might want to listen to again. So no, don't give it away. Tell your friends, all of them, that they should buy this audiobook. It's fine to lie to them about how good it is. The important thing is to tell them to buy it. Because lately, I'm starting to think that on the show business drug addict forgiveness meter, I'm inching closer to Jeff Conaway than Robert Downey Jr. each and every day. Well, I gotta go. Take it easy. And I hope to see you all back here next book. This is Artie Lang in New York City, September 26, 2008. Salud, Chindan, Broccoli Ra, Beats Again, Shriadel, Fire! This is Artie Lang. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Too Fat to Fish by Artie Lang with Anthony Boza. read for you by the Reverend Bob Levy, Gary Delabate, Jim Florentine, and moi, Artie Lang. This program was produced and directed by Dan Zitt. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2008 by Artie Lang. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.